This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, welcome to another round of Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with two of the world's top climate scientists, talking about the severe challenges we face right now and in the future. From the United Kingdom, we have Dr. Kevin Anderson, who pulls no punches. Then Rutger distinguished scientist Alan Robach tells us why geoengineering might not be such a good idea. Open your ears and your mind to what's coming next. Dr. Kevin Anderson is a professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester in the UK. He's also deputy director of the Tyndall Centre, a multi-university project for the study of climate change. Kevin has advised the UK government and the European Union. Kevin Anderson, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time. Let's get to some of the many questions about the reality of climate change and the human predicament. It seems that climate impacts expected decades from now are arriving much sooner. There's a long list from disappearing sea ice to melting in Antarctica. What surprises you?
Well, firstly, I think as scientists, we have to be very careful in differentiating between what appears to be the case, if you like, anecdote and the actual statistical evidence. So some things that we're fairly clear about here from the statistics, from the science, are the loss of Arctic ice and indeed the West Peninsula in Antarctica. So we can identify these things, and we're very confident these are a consequence of human emissions of greenhouse gases. When it comes to some of the other issues and the recent typhoon Pam or Haiyan, we have to be very careful there to say that these are climate change events. We cannot say that at the moment. All we can say is that these are consistent with what we would expect to see from the climate models. As scientists, we have to embed everything that we say in the actual science. So it's easy for the skeptics, if you like, to counter with quite unscientific statements. As for us as scientists, we have to be much more cautious in the language that we use. So there are certain impacts that we're seeing, such as the sea level rise and some of the loss of ice, which we are confident are consequences of human greenhouse gas emissions. But some of the other ones that are often attributed to climate change in the press, we would have to be more cautious about the language that we would use there and say that they are consistent with the models. We do know for certain that some of the additional damage that is caused is from human emissions, because we know the sea level rise is from what we've done, from our greenhouse gas emissions, and that exacerbates the damage when we have these big typhoons and storm events such as Sandy as well. But we have to be careful, I think, as scientists, to make sure we never stray outside of what our science tells us. And that's problematic, I think, for many people, because they would like us to be a bit clearer sometimes about particular things that we're seeing on almost a day-to-day basis. But as scientists, we have to collect that data, and gradually over time, the anecdote becomes statistically significant, and then we can make some stronger scientifically supportive statement. But we can certainly make that now about sea ice, and what we're seeing in the Arctic is a really good bellwether for the sorts of changes we're going to see around the globe. It really does indicate very significant warming has been occurring, and the scale of the impacts look to be very significant as well.
Well, look, we're seeing wave after wave of important climate science coming out these days. What are some of the papers that you think are really important?
I'm going to say here, and it's perhaps an easy one to say, but actually the latest set of IPCC reports, and I wouldn't say all of the reports, actually, one particular dimension of the IPCC report, I think, is most important. And that is that the latest set, particularly the Working Group 1, which is this main scientific report, it's captured something explicitly this time called carbon budgets. Now, implicitly, they've been in the science, well, since the science of climate change began. But the carbon budget, in other words, the total amount of carbon dioxide that we can put into the atmosphere for any particular temperature, is a really important scientific framing of the issue that gives us a much better handle for understanding what we have to do in terms of policy. So it removes a lot of the wiggle room that's been deliberately used and abused by policymakers, and actually says we have a certain carbon budget, a certain amount of carbon dioxide that we can emit for the temperature that we have politically decided we must not go above, which is, for instance, the 2°C temperature threshold. And the IPCC report gives us very clear carbon budgets with probabilities associated with them, and they should become very useful in us assessing the viability or otherwise of different policies that governments are putting forward. So I think that's probably the most important change we've seen, in that it provides a scientific basis at last for us to assess policymakers' recommendations. Another paper I think I would put alongside that, and it's by colleagues of mine, not within the Tyndall Centre, but elsewhere in the UK, is a paper by Christoph McGlade and Paul Eakins. Now, I have some disagreements with some of their conclusions, but overall what they're showing is that given the carbon budgets that we have, then we are going to have to keep most of the conventional fossil fuels in the ground. That means we cannot really be exploiting additional unconventional fossil fuels such as the tar sands, coal bed methane, or indeed probably most of the shale gas around the globe. That would probably have to stay within the ground. So that's a really important piece of work. So in showing that if we want to abide by the commitments that policymakers have made, that civil society, that we have all agreed to, then we cannot burn anything like our current levels of fossil fuels, let alone try to pursue any more. The reason I have some small disagreement with their paper is that they did embed a significant amount of negative emission technologies, geoengineering, if you like, within their analysis. And I think that even their work, which is really quite strident and really pushing how much of the fossil fuels you have to keep in the ground, I still think that is too optimistic, because I'm more pessimistic about the likely success of geoengineering technologies in the future.
Right. Well, that's a worry that several parties have raised, that the lower pathways or warming scenarios presented by the IPCC also seem to assume a technology for removing CO2 will be found and implemented by 2100. Is that true? Did they assume that? And with no such technology available, is that a reasonable assumption?
Well, this is something I've been doing some significant work on with other colleagues of mine in the Tyndall Centre, and very clearly, the wealth of low-carbon scenarios that have been generated around the globe, so low-carbon futures, trying to think about what the future might look like, virtually all of those, with the very occasional exception, does assume that these geoengineering technologies will work. And they almost always assume negative emission technologies, and they almost always assume within that something called BECCS, which is we grow bioenergy, and then we use that in power stations, and then we capture the carbon dioxide from this energy, and then we put that underground. And that they say that this effectively sucks the CO2 out of the atmosphere. The problem, of course, is partly there, is that we need the ground for growing food for a growing population. We also need the ground for making biofuels. So the aviation industry thinks it's going to use that, the shipping industry, the car industry, the cement industry, and we're going to use it for sucking CO2 out the ground, and we're going to feed 9 billion people. And unless you've got an additional planet, it does appear that there are far too many pressures being put on the land around our globe in these future scenarios. So I think that they are misleading in a lot of the scenarios, because they all have it in, rather than say one or two out of every 10. And they all assume it's going to work, and they always assume that it will fit nice and successfully into these sort of modeled futures. I think that is misleading. Every single, as I understand it, all of the new scenarios that have been used by the IPCC, they're given the acronym RCPs, Representation Concentration Pathways, Representative Concentration Pathways, these new scenarios all assume negative emission technologies, geoengineering in them. And I think that is very misleading. And I've been saying that for probably 5 or 6 years at least. And I know quite a lot of scientists are genuinely concerned about how come they are being assumed to work, when we simply do not know if that will be the case or not.
Kevin Anderson, how do you feel about solar radiation management, the geoengineering technique to cool the world?
This is a very contentious issue, and to me, probably a very simple analogy is it's a little bit like having gangrene, and then in the early stages, you start putting a plaster over the part that's infected. But of course, it's going to carry on underneath that, and ultimately, you're going to suffer the consequences. And I see solar radiation management being a little bit like that. It may well be that in some niche places, it might be helpful in the future if it could work. But the idea that we can somehow reflect the sunlight back into space through one mechanism or another, that we can do that reliably over many, many decades, I think is actually, well, it's problematic from a technical point of view, but also from a governance point of view. Can you get global governance to agree with that? Which parts of the world do we protect and which parts do we not protect? At the same time, it gives policymakers, it gives the public, it gives all of us an excuse to say, let's not bother reducing our emissions because we can reflect the sunlight to compensate for the additional heat from the carbon dioxide. And therefore, the carbon dioxide levels go up in the atmosphere. That means if ever at some point there's some, say, tension around the globe, so there'll be some military tension, we may no longer be keeping up this solar radiation management, which would mean we would see quite a quick, steep increase in the temperature because the carbon dioxide would have been emitted. We also It also does not stop acidification of the oceans, which is a growing concern. That means that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will be absorbed into the surface oceans. And we already are seeing a change in the pH, the acidity of the surface oceans, which affects the food balance of those oceans. So I think it's a dangerous technique in many respects. Firstly, technically, I think it will be challenging to do reliably in the appropriate areas. Second, I think it's going to be really challenging in terms of governance. And third, it is a huge distraction from actually removing the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That's not to say we shouldn't do some research on it, but we have to be very careful to be doing that research with the assumption, the underpinning assumption, that it does not work. Now, if it does work in the future, maybe we can try and have to use it then. But I think if we are planning the future with the assumption that it works, that is very misguided and very dangerous. So my personal view is we have to be very, very careful with solar radiation management, because it is only really a sticking plaster to a much more fundamental problem.
Many of us, as you know, were disappointed with the Copenhagen climate talks in 2009. Should we expect much from the Paris climate talks at the end of 2015?
I think we will see something that will be interpreted as more successful than Copenhagen. Whether in reality, in terms of climate change, it will mean anything substantial or not, I think it's very uncertain. All is to play for in Paris. So if someone asked me, you know, to put money on Paris, I think it will fail in terms of putting in the right mechanism to bring about the scale of change in reducing our emissions that we actually need to avoid dangerous climate change. I think we will fail. But that's still up there for us to fight for. You know, Paris 2015 is in December, so we have the rest of this year to make sure our message gets across, to get the public more involved, businesses more involved, to make us realize how serious this issue is. And there's a small chance that Paris could come up with something that is worthwhile. So all is to play for. I think the chances are slim, but I think it's a really important opportunity. And if we do not push hard, we will rue the day when we have not tried to bring about at least some much better global agreement, understanding of the challenge of the situation, and start to put pressure from that on the different nations, on the policymakers, on all of us, to actually make the real changes that the science is making very clear. We have to make those sorts of changes, those sorts of levels of reductions. To date, all we really have heard on climate change has been rhetoric. No nation has really shown any leadership in line with what would be necessary to meet the commitments that we've signed up to internationally. So we have had pretty much a quarter of a century of abject failure on climate change. Our emissions today are 60% higher than they were in 1990 at the time of the first IPCC report. Our growth rate in emissions has increased very significantly. This year looks like it might actually be, hopefully, the start of some change, but it's just 1 year's data at the moment that suggests that emissions from energy may have stabilized, may have peaked, but my feeling is that it's probably just a 1 year signal and we will go back to growth next year. Let's hope not. But we have everything to play for in Paris. If we fail, then we are effectively failing to take care and concern for our own children's future.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with the well-known climate scientist from the UK, Kevin Anderson, at the University of Manchester. What are your thoughts, Kevin, about developments in the Arctic? Are you concerned about potential methane releases there, permafrost melting, Arctic drilling, or what?
Well, in terms of the additional methane emissions from the Arctic and from the permafrost and so forth, then these are really important areas that we need to understand much better than we do now. What we know for certain is that this is happening. It is likely to almost certainly the case that it's happening because of the additional warming we're seeing. The actual impact, the amount of gases, of greenhouse gases, particularly methane, that we're going to see released, and that is quite hard to evaluate. My colleagues who work on these particular sets of feedback mechanisms are concerned about them. But the ones that I work most closely with would say that they do not completely negate the benefits of all the other changes that we can make. So they would mean effectively that our carbon budget was significantly smaller than it already is. So in terms of what we'd have to do, the more carbon and the more methane that is emitted from the Arctic in this way, then that's the less carbon dioxide we can emit from our energy systems, from our food systems, and from our industrial processes. So it has big implications for what we would have to do in terms of stabilizing at a safe climate level. Beyond that, the other point is about things like the drilling in the Arctic. I mean, I think, you know, the irony here that we are losing the Arctic because of our profligate use of fossil fuels and knowing use. We have been using it knowingly, knowing that it's going to affect the climate for 25 years. And now we're almost celebrating that we're losing the Arctic, which will give us access to additional mineral rights, additional oil exploration, and possibly shorter sea passages for ships to make goods even cheaper than they are now. So So there are a whole reason, set of reasons why I have concern about what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere and the Arctic, which relate from the natural releases, but the releases of methane from the permafrost and so forth through to our direct exploitation of the impacts of climate change in that region from, for instance, the reduction in the amount of ice and therefore our opportunity to go in there and drill for more oil. There seems to be something almost quite sad that we as a species cannot see the irony in that, or that our desire for more hydrocarbons outweighs our concern for the future, and again for future generations, for our own future and the future of our own children and those elsewhere in the world that live in more vulnerable communities.
For myself, it seems like we're like heroin addicts. We love that oil and we'll do anything to get it, even though we know it may be killing us and other species. I wanted to ask you, do you agree with Dr. Jennifer Francis that changes in the Arctic have altered the jet stream?
I have to say on this, I mean, this is the sort of thing where we have to be quite careful as scientists. That is not my particular area of expertise. I'm aware that other people have discussed this. The actual jet stream, again, is something, is a very complex phenomena of our climate. And that this is where there's ongoing science in these areas. But certainly, I've heard from experts I know in the area in the UK and elsewhere have been talking about adjustments to the jet stream from human-induced anthropogenic climate change for several years now. So it is a serious issue. That's the sort of scale of change that we are bringing about, where our emissions from simply driving our cars, putting our lights on, from just living the lives that we lead, are sufficient in only a few decades to be starting to have impacts at the jet stream level. You know, fundamental changes to our climate have been brought about by really not much more than 50 years of emissions, because really it's only been the last 50 or so years where we've put very large quantities of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So I share her concern about what we're seeing at these very large climatic scale adjustments that are likely or appear to be related to the additional warming from our greenhouse gases.
Do you have any guesses as to how long it will be before climate change pushes things like heat waves, drought, or storms strong enough to really threaten the world food supply?
Well, I think that's already happening, but it happens to poor people in vulnerable parts of the community that are a long way from where the media are, that are a long way from the people who, like me, who are the significant emitters. So I think that those things are already happening to people, but because they're culturally removed and geographically removed and poor, we broadly have not shown any concern about them other than a little bit rhetorical language. So I think those things are occurring. They will start to occur significantly more as the temperature keeps going up and the changes in climate, change in water patterns. And we already start to see some adjustments to food availability around the world in the terms of prices, for instance. They're triggered both by adjustments to the climate around the globe, but they're also triggered to a certain extent by our response to emissions by increased use of, say, palm oil or other biomass, which we're now using rather for sometimes necessarily for food, we're using it for energy. So, and that's also then pushing up food prices. So what we're starting to see is both from an impacts point of view and from trying to do something about it in terms of using more bioenergy, that those two together are both putting additional pressures on the food system, which is one of the reasons I raised my concern earlier, that if you add geoengineering to that, which at the moment is to use even more land for growing bioenergy, which we can then use to suck the CO2 out of the air with, that you ally these or put these all together. And I start to see that a very challenging future, particularly for those people who are do not have the wherewithal to be able to buy the food as the prices start to go up. So we have seen already in the world, people suffering from significant increases in food prices. So I don't like the idea of thinking this is a problem for the future. It's a problem for today. Unfortunately, it's not affecting those of us who are the high emitters at the moment.
As you've noticed, there's been a series of scientific papers in just the last few weeks forming a chorus of reasons why we may experience a jump in warming within this decade. Have you heard that, and would you agree?
This is the ongoing process of science. There seems the arguments that are being put forward do have some very strong scientific basis. They appear to be appropriate sets of arguments. And it is a natural process of science that we go through these things. The papers are put out there, they're reviewed, they're thought about, other people do additional research around it. And at the moment, it does appear that that's a reasonable case to make. I think we have to be quite careful in again saying that's definitely going to occur. There's certainly some evidence, strong evidence, to suggest that various levels of warming have been masked by things that we are starting to understand much better than we understood before, Nevertheless, I think we have to be quite cautious in saying that we're going to suddenly see a big leap in the rate of warming over the next few years, because there'll be some additional changes in the way the climate works, in the way that El Nino works and so forth. So these are more reasons to be cautious. So I think if we were prudent, if we took the view of a precautionary approach to the welfare of our planet, then these are really important papers that should tell us that we need to be careful, and even more careful, in what it is we're doing. I think we also, though, as scientists, we have to be very careful in not pushing too far and saying that this is very clear evidence that this will be the case. I think at the moment the jury is still out, but the scientific consensus, I would say, is leaning towards the idea that we will likely see an increase in the rates of warming, and that the papers and the science that we have is probably adequately understanding that. But we have some way to go, I think, on that scientific understanding yet.
Now, the worst-case scenario put out by the IPCC is 8.5 degrees C of warming over pre-industrial times by the year 2100. I've heard that's the path we're on now if we don't change anything. Do you think our civilization could survive the multiple ecological impacts of a warming of 8.5 degrees C over an 85-year period?
Well, I think that's I think that's a slight misunderstanding of what the RCP, what the scenarios in the IPCC are saying. The highest scenario they have, which is called RC, they've all got very awkward names, RCP 8.5, does not relate directly to temperature. It relates to something else, which is another measure of the level of warming, but not, it is not temperature. If you look at the highest scenario they're considering, the temperature rise is up to sort of about 5 to 6 degrees C by the end of the century. Although it's called RCP 8.5, the temperature it looks at by the end of the century is sort of the 5 to 6 degrees C temperature rise. Now, okay, that's not 8.5, but that is still an incredible increase in temperature over an almost instant in terms of any sort of way that ecosystems can respond, or possibly even societies respond. This is almost an instant shock. But in as little as a couple of generations, we are seeing temperatures rising by that sort of level. We have never had that during human civilization. We've never had it. Well, we haven't seen those sorts of temperature rises for many, many millions of years. So we are putting in place an experiment to levels that our own understanding of that sort of future is limited. What we do know, what we do understand, suggests that almost at every level, from our physical infrastructure, the way that our societies are relatively stable, from things like military tension in terms of access to resources, from the collapse of a lot of ecosystems that we survive with, that we rely on, from everything from pollination of bees to access to food in the oceans, to all of these systems that are fundamental for how we and the rest of the planet survives and works in reasonable balance, that these are all being very significantly threatened by our current pathway. So I have, and again, this is anecdotal, but I have spoken to scientists for probably 10 to 15 years on about this, about a higher temperature future. And I was used to talk about 4, possibly 5 degrees temperature rise future by the end of the century. And I have not come across any scientists who do not see that as incredibly worrying, and that it's probably beyond what we can adapt to. It is beyond what most ecosystems can deal with. So it's a world that we have to avoid at all costs. So we are currently on that path towards a really very devastating future.
Well, this is all rather frightening. Can you see a way for society to reorganize to keep the temperature at some sort of safe level that we can deal with, or is it already too late for that?
It's already too late for many vulnerable people in some of the parts of the Southern Hemisphere. So we have to be blunt about this, that we have already removed the opportunities of good quality of lives for many people in the Southern Hemisphere. In fact, you know, we're making their lives, we will be devastating their lives and their incomes and their families and so forth. That is already ongoing, and that is going to get worse because we have not cared enough to reduce our emissions. I think there are many things that we can do technically, socially, behaviorally, politically, all of which would make economic sense in the traditional form of economics, which is about, you know, stewardship of how we look after our own lives, our resources, our well-being in our country and so forth. All of that fits together to make a much lower carbon future. We have not chosen to do any of that at the moment at every level, whether it's the technologies, whether it's the behavior, and whether it's our politics. At every level, we have been found wanting. We have not put the time and effort and diligence into moving towards a low carbon future. I think it is possible. I think we could, most of us around the globe would benefit very significantly from those changes, even in the relatively short to medium term. At the moment, we collectively, it's not just the policymakers, it's all of us in civil society, need to some extent hang our heads in shame when we really think about our own children and future generations, because we know what we are handing them. We know we are bequeathing them this appalling future, and we are not prepared to make changes and adjustments to our own lives, our own societies, our own countries, our own businesses. So at the moment, the signs are not looking good that we will be able to avoid very dangerous climate change. But we have all the opportunities there to do so. And that is the role of people like myself, scientists, and other people, civil society, communities, NGOs, and businesses, anyone who's interested in climate change, to drive the agenda in a more positive way than it has been driven so far. But the way we are going now, which is just lots of hot air and discussion around climate change, will mean that we will simply be creeping our children an appalling future.
We have been speaking with Dr. Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester in the UK and Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre. Find links to what we've discussed in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Kevin Anderson, thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. Next up, Alan Robach. And then Heather Woodbury tells us about her new eco-comic series, As the Globe Warms. What if geoengineering to save the climate turns out badly? What could go wrong? Alan Robach has some questions and the science to back them up. As a distinguished professor of environmental science at Rutgers University, Alan has published over 200 peer-reviewed scientific papers. He's an editor at the important earth sciences journal called Reviews of Geophysics. Alan has been a lead author in the reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Later, we'll also ask Dr. Robach about another application of climate science. What happens if there is an exchange of nuclear weapons? Could that stop global warming? Alan Robach, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, look, it's been 6 years since we last talked, and then you had a bunch of reasons why geoengineering might not be such a good idea. How is your list holding up?
Then I had 20 reasons. We're talking, by the way, about stratospheric aerosols emulating a volcanic eruption. The word geoengineering can apply to other things, but that's what I'm focusing on. Then I had 20 reasons why it might not be a good idea. I've crossed a couple off, but I've added some, and now I'm up to 26 reasons.
Okay, well, now I'd like to talk about, yes, as you say, solar radiation management, and that's where particles are injected into the atmosphere to cool the planet by blocking the sun, in a nutshell. And let's start with the smaller proposal in the polar region, as called for by the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. Talk to us, Alan, about what happens if we try limited solar radiation management to cool the Arctic. What did you find?
You can't just cool one part of the planet and keep it isolated from the rest. There's no walls in the atmosphere. So our climate model simulations show that if you try to put a cloud in the atmosphere over the Arctic, it will actually be blown by the winds to lower latitudes and affect the climate of the entire hemisphere, if not the planet.
Well, so that would affect what? In North America, could it affect our crops here or in Russia?
Well, first of all, we don't know how to do geoengineering. No technology currently exists, and so we don't even know if it's possible. There are ideas of flying airplanes up and spraying sulfur gas out and having it form particles like after large volcanic eruptions, but we don't know whether we could form particles of the desired size to have the effects that people have talked about. So, but assuming that you could do it, it would cool the Asian continent more than the ocean, and it would reduce the summer monsoon winds and summer monsoon rainfall. And so our simulations show that there would be a reduction of rainfall in a region where a couple billion people depend on it for their food supply.
And then looking at your graphs with the Arctic experiment, it looks like global mean temperatures go right back up to where they would have been within a decade or two of stopping injecting those aerosols into the atmosphere. Why would we stop once we start?
Well, that's true of any such scheme. Imagine you start doing geoengineering and there's a big drought in China or floods in India, and they say, you damn geoengineers, you're causing this. We demand that you stop it. And you say, well, there's natural variability. You can't prove that this flood or drought wouldn't have happened anyway. They say, we don't care. We think you're doing it. Stop. And so it would be very difficult to continue doing it in the light of that. And so I can imagine that society would lose the will or the means to do it. Or some other catastrophic weather event happened, and whether or not you could connect it to the geoengineering, people would connect it and demand that it be stopped.
What sort of experiment did you run for injecting these in the tropics with larger amounts?
We organized this geoengineering model intercomparison project where climate modeling groups from around the world did the same experiment, and we compared the results of the climate models. And so one experiment we did was just turning down the sun and balancing an increase of carbon dioxide. Another was to spray sulfur into the tropics and let the winds carry it around the world like they do after volcanic eruptions. In these cases, we did find a reduction of the summer monsoon precipitation in Africa and Asia. There are a lot of other things we found too, but that was one of the things that we found.
But it does look like injecting a lot of pollution above the tropics could really cool the planet by as much as 1 degree C from where it would be with our current emissions. So can we say, Alan, that geoengineering, if we could do it, could work?
Well, if we could do it, yes. So I have a list of 5 reasons why you might want to do it. And the number one benefit is that it could reduce the warming caused by greenhouse gases. And so it would reduce the negative impacts of global warming. It could reduce the extreme weather, extreme rainfall events. It could reduce sea level rise and sea ice melting, and it would then push back against what's being caused by global warming.
And you've raised twice now one of the biggest worries, and that is that the impact on precipitation could be greater than the effect on temperature. Is it possible, as you've just talked about, that billions of people could have their crops affected?
There's a lot of variability in the weather, in the precipitation. So sometimes the monsoon is not as strong as other years, and some years it's stronger. And so the statistics would change, and it could affect the food supply because of the impacts on precipitation. We've actually run a crop model to look at in the future if there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but it doesn't get much warmer and the precipitation changes a little bit, how it would affect crop production in China, which is the area with the largest crop production in the world. And we did not find a large impact on crop production in that instance, partly because the increased carbon dioxide acts as a fertilizer and makes crops grow better. We need a lot more work on that for all the crops around the world and for different scenarios, and we're in the middle of working on that right now. But it doesn't look like there's a dramatic change in agricultural productivity because of geoengineering. So although it's something to be worried about, we haven't shown that it's a deal breaker at this point. That's why we need more research, both to look at the benefits and the risks so we can make informed policy decisions in the future.
So you would support the new call from the U.S. National Academy of Science for more research into geoengineering?
Yes. It was an excellent report written by a very excellent team of people. I testified to them. I reviewed it, and I agree with all of their recommendations.
I guess an obvious question is, what happens to the billions of dollars spent on solar energy if we darken the sky to cool things off?
If you darken the sky by 1% or 2% at the most, that's how much you would lose in solar energy that's produced by solar photovoltaic cells, the normal solar panels like I have on my roof. The other technique, which is focusing the direct sunlight in massive plants to boil water or some other liquid, is more efficient. That would be dramatically affected by this procedure because you would have much less direct sunlight and a lot more diffuse sunlight. So the sky would be hazy, and so the direct sunlight might be reduced by 10, 20, 30%. After the Mount Pinatubo eruption in 1991, such factories, such solar generation plants did have a 34% reduction of solar generation that next summer. So those systems would be dramatically affected. Solar photovoltaics would have a very small impact.
So humans could actually make the sky more white than blue?
Yes.
Ouch.
And I gave a talk about this in China once, and I said there'd be no more blue skies, and the students looked at me and they didn't know what I was talking about. So in very polluted places, of course, there's no more blue sky anymore anyway, but in clean areas, the sky would be whiter, and there have been studies calculating how much whiter it would be, and it depends on how much you put up, of course, and what the size of the particles are.
Do you think that the management of solar radiation could affect the ozone layer, and what would that mean?
Definitely. There's chlorine up in the stratosphere now because of our emission of freons and other gases. And every spring over Antarctica, we get the ozone hole because clouds form in the stratosphere and chemical reactions take place on the cloud droplets that release the chlorine and it destroys ozone. The chlorine is going to be there for decades into the future, even though we've stopped emitting it. So if you put a cloud into the stratosphere globally by doing geoengineering, these same reactions would take place globally and you would have ozone depletion. And that would allow more ultraviolet radiation to reach the surface.
Which could increase cancer rates, for one thing.
It would increase cancer rates. It would affect lots of all life on Earth, not just humans.
Right. So, Alan, in the end, do you think we will become so desperate or so wedded to fossil fuels that we really will inject pollution into the sky to block the sun?
So I'm a good weather forecaster. I'm not such a good forecaster of human behavior, but right now I think no. I think the governance aspects will not be soluble. How do we set the planetary thermostat? How do we decide what temperature we want the planet to be? Nations where it's cold, like Canada, Russia, maybe in the U.S., wouldn't mind a little bit of warming because you could exploit the Arctic. But islands that are drowning in the tropics right now would like it to be even cooler than it is now. We suffered through the Hurricane Sandy here at the Jersey Shore 2 years ago, and it was more dangerous because of the global warming that's taken place already. The sea level is higher, so there was more flooding. The storm was stronger because the ocean is warmer. This terrible typhoon that hit Vanuatu a few days ago was stronger and more dangerous because of the global warming that's taken place already. And so I don't know how we could decide how to manage the planet.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with the famous scientist Alan Robach from Rutgers. Alan, we've talked about cooling down the Earth, but you have another area of expertise which finds a way we might be able to stop global warming altogether, and that's an old-fashioned nuclear war. Could that really stop climate change?
Yeah. Geoengineering, as risky as it might be, wouldn't kill people directly, but if you drop bombs on cities, killing millions of people and produce fires, the smoke from the fires would make it very cold for a decade or two. What would stop global warming is that it would destroy civilization and we would stop burning fossil fuels. Mm. I don't recommend that, by the way.
Not a good solution. So what is nuclear winter? Could you please describe it?
Nuclear weapons are targeted at cities and industrial areas. And unfortunately, we have the example that cities burn. We have San Francisco after the fire in 1906, and we have a number of cities during World War II targeted by conventional weapons as well as nuclear weapons. The smoke would go up into the atmosphere, heated by the sun, and lofted into the stratosphere where there's no rain to wash it out. It would last for a couple decades and absorb sunlight and block out the sun. If there was a war between the United States and Russia, there would be enough smoke to make it so cold that it would get below freezing in the summertime in the middle of continents. And so we call that nuclear winter. The temperature would be, it would be winter time all the time. We've also studied a scenario of a so-called small nuclear war between India and Pakistan on the other side of the world, using only 50 Hiroshima-size atomic bombs, the smallest ones that can be made. And that would produce so much smoke that it would cause climate change unprecedented in recorded human history. And it wouldn't be below freezing, so it wouldn't be nuclear winter. But we've calculated how it would affect agricultural production in the United States and China. We're working on other places. And it would reduce the production of grains, rice and wheat, by 20 to 40% for 5 years and up to 30% for a decade. And so this would be a huge reduction of the food supply on the planet. And you can imagine after this, people would stop trading food, there would be panic, and there would be famine.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying what we would call a small nuclear war, if there is any such thing, between India and Pakistan would affect crops in North America and possibly in Europe as well?
Oh, it would affect crops around the world because the smoke would go up into the atmosphere and be blown around the world. So it would have global climatic impacts, yes. It's hard to imagine, you know, along the Kashmiri border. So what if there's a fight between India and Pakistan? We don't have to worry about it, but it would really affect us.
Well, okay, so that says we have all of us a stake in making sure nuclear weapons never get used. But it's so confusing that the instability in Pakistan, we can't affect policy much in India. We have apparently no control over what North Korea does with their nuclear weapons. What can we do?
North Korea doesn't have enough nuclear weapons to do this, but all the other 8 countries that have nuclear weapons could do this. The solution, of course, is to ban nuclear weapons. Chemical weapons have been banned internationally. Biological weapons have been banned. Landmines have been banned. Cluster munitions have been banned. But the worst weapon of mass destruction of all, nuclear weapons, have not been banned. And so it turns out the situation is not mutual assured destruction. It's self-assured destruction. If one country attacked another and the other country did nothing back, the climate change from the smoke from those fires would come back to hurt everybody in the country that did the attacking. And so the solution is just to get rid of the nuclear weapons. We'd be much safer without them. And this is an easier problem to solve than global warming, because the amount of money, the amount of people's careers invested in nuclear weapons is much smaller than the entire world energy structure.
Have we done a sociological study to find out whether we really could manage the geopolitical situation without nuclear weapons? I mean, we've built up a world that kind of depends on these ultimate threats.
Well, but the threat it's only a threat if you believe people would actually use the weapons. I mean, they don't provide a deterrence. Look at all the examples of nuclear nations that have been attacked by non-nuclear nations where they have not deterred them. We can look at the Falkland Islands, where Argentina attacked nuclear UK. We can look at the Afghanistan war, where 2 nuclear nations ended up losing, Russia and the United States. We can look at the 6 Days War in Israel, where Israel was attacked and they were a nuclear nation. Did nuclear weapons stop Russia, the Soviet Union, from invading Eastern Europe after World War II when we were the only nuclear nation? They don't work as a deterrent.
And I keep hearing rumors that America's thinking about updating their nuclear arsenal or spending more billions on new ones. What's happening with that, do you know?
It's not a rumor. I mean, the plans are to spend over $300 billion over the next decade modernizing our nuclear weapons, maybe up to $1 trillion. What's really dangerous is our missiles. They're launch on warning, because missiles in the ground, if they are attacked, they can't be used. Missiles on submarines, on airplanes, are virtually invulnerable. So we have a system where if we think we're being attacked, we have only a few minutes to decide whether to launch our weapons or to lose them. If we would take these off launch on warning and get rid of our land-based missiles, the whole world would be much more stable. That would be the first step to take. And President Obama can reduce our nuclear arsenal without an agreement with Russia. I talked to Rose Gottmuller, his nuclear aide, a little more than a year ago, and I said, why doesn't he just reduce our nuclear weapons? He doesn't need to have an agreement with Putin. This would set an example. I mean, how can we expect Iran not to have nuclear weapons if we keep ours? It's like you're sitting in a bar drinking, telling people not to drink. Why should they listen to you? And so if Obama wants to really make us think that he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, this is what he has to do for his legacy. Just take our weapons off launch on warning and start getting rid of our nuclear weapons. And she said, oh, we can't do that. We can't do that. And I said, but actually there's a precedent. George H.W. Bush started reducing our nuclear weapons without the Russians as the Soviet Union was coming apart. Oh, that was different. That was different. But she didn't really explain why. So it's very frustrating to me that Obama is doing some things like changing our relationship to Cuba, doing more on global warming. But this is an issue where he hasn't really done what he said he was going to do.
And it's been 25 years since the original nuclear winter work. Are we more sure now with newer science that this would happen?
Yes. The first models, the global climate models that were run in the 1980s, were run on the Cray 1 computer, which was much less powerful than the iPhone in your pocket. Now we have modern computers and modern computer models that can do multiple simulations over many years, over many decades, using the entire atmosphere. And the more we look at it in more detail, the surer we are that the science was right. It's pretty simple. If you block out the sun, it gets cold. And so, it turns out with our modern computer models, we discovered that the smoke would last much longer than we thought before, because now the models have the sun heat the smoke and loft it into the upper stratosphere, lasting much longer than we thought before.
How long is much longer?
Well, we only ran them for a year or two before, and we didn't have the first simulations ran for 20 days. Now we know that after a couple decades before the smoke will disappear.
Wow, there wouldn't be much living left underneath that. So in New York City this past February, the well-known anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott just held a symposium on the dynamics of nuclear extinction. You spoke there, I know that. I've got a recording of the audio, and people can find that, a link to that, on my blog at ecoshock.info. Is that going too far? Could we really go extinct as a species due to nuclear weapons?
I don't think so. Helen stayed at my house the night before and gave a talk at Rutgers, too. It's hard to imagine that humans would go extinct. 74,000 years ago, there was the Toba volcanic eruption, which put so much stuff in the atmosphere, it got very cold as it would get with nuclear winter. It's called a volcanic winter. And we think that a lot of humans died, and there was a human genetic bottleneck, and we're all descended from the people that were lucky enough or smart enough to survive. Even that didn't kill all the humans. Now, there's so many more humans, some far spread around the world. There's no nuclear weapons in the Southern Hemisphere, and so people in the Southern Hemisphere, if you lived in New Zealand, there'd be a lot of sheep and mussels to eat and fish, and it wouldn't get as cold because you're surrounded by an ocean with a lot of heat capacity. So it's hard to imagine that you'd go to a more primitive lifestyle. You know, modern medicines and computers and stuff would be out of commission for a while, but it's hard to imagine that we would go extinct.
And yet I still don't feel very good about the whole topic.
No. it could be horrible without us going extinct. There's no reason to get to that point, of course.
And, you know, it's hard to find a less popular topic than nuclear weapons. Most people would rather not hear about it and plan to avoid thinking about it. What can we do? I mean, you've talked a little bit about what we could do to protect the long future, but in the face of this fear and apathy, can we get any public support for changing it?
It's very frustrating. I give talks and people get depressed, and I try to tell them, you know, how we can change it at the end. But you know, it's like Mark Twain said, denial ain't just a river in Egypt. People want to pretend that they never heard about it. And just like you said, it's pretty frustrating. We had Carl Sagan to help us in the 1980s, who was such an excellent communicator, but he's not around. And so we haven't been able to find a spokesman who's as eloquent as he is. I asked Neil deGrasse Tyson to include it in his recent Cosmos show, but he said he wasn't going to do it. So we're still trying to get more attention to this. Maybe the Nobel Peace Prize this year, every 10 years, it seems to be about a nuclear issue. Maybe it'll be to somebody who can raise this issue again. But I had this surreal experience of being invited down to Cuba to give my talk about nuclear winter, and Fidel Castro listened for an hour, and afterwards he blogged that we have to get rid of all of our nuclear weapons. And so he got it. But he doesn't have any nuclear weapons anymore. So we need the countries that have them to stop thinking of nuclear weapons as just bigger bombs, bigger bullets, and understand the consequences. And it's pretty frustrating. We keep trying to get people's attention, but if you have any ideas, I'd like to hear them.
Well, part of it is just to try and get the word out through this radio program. You know, Alan, as we wrap up, I've always thought of nuclear weapons as a sign of basic insanity in the human race, and now we want to control the climate, the weather, and the rain with the same mentality. I'm wondering if we should add basic human insanity to your list of reasons why geoengineering may not be such a good idea.
Well, Donald Rumsfeld is right about one thing. There are unknown unknowns, and so we don't really know what we don't know about what would happen. I mean, would you trust the whole world to this one technical solution? I mean, anybody who is in a car today and had their seatbelt on understands this concept. Anything made by humans and operated by humans can not function, can break or be operated poorly. And so that's one of the reasons why it would be very scary to try and control the whole world on purpose like this.
From New Jersey, we've been speaking with the Distinguished Professor of Climate Science at Rutgers University, Dr. Alan Robach. You can find links to his website, more notes and audio from his recent talk in New York City, and the 20 reasons why geoengineering may be a bad idea, all in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Alan, we've only talked a couple of times, but I do consider you to be a friend of the future. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As the climate crisis deepens, we don't really know how to grasp it, and that's when we call in the arts, our pathway to the heart and to the inner brain. Heather Woodbury has a one-woman play with a huge cast for this coming Earth Day. Heather has been recognized in the performing arts with awards. Her work has spread into books and public radio and inspired many. Now Heather is launching a climate change novel on stage, but wait, we'll let her tell you about it. Heather Woodbury, welcome to Radio Eco Shock.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, tell us about your new work titled As the Globe Warms.
Okay, well, my new work right now on Earth Day is going to come out as an audio serial, a sort of epic radio play. And you are quite correct, it began as a stage play. Basically, about 5 years ago, I began performing installments of a story that I made up as I went along. And then that was condensed into a still epic stage play that took 6 nights to perform. And now I have this 12-episode version coming out on audio on Earth Day.
And what brought you to bring climate change into your art?
Well, I felt very moved and worried about, to say the least, about what I was reading about, you know, what was happening to our climate and our effect on all of millions of species on this planet that we share this home with. But I would say that it was a personal prompt, which was my mother passing away, that just really made me understand the value of a life in a way that I think one can only experience when you lose somebody very dear to you. And it just made me want to contribute in the way that I could. And the way that I do is I tell big, long, entertaining, comic, and also dramatic stories. And so I thought, I think I'm going to make my next big story about climate change and about the issues that I think are the most important.
Well, you raise a good point there. I think someone passing reminds us that we are all passing generations. There will be new generations, and they're going to have to face the problems that we're creating for them. Now, I love that you tested this piece of work in Florida and Texas, where, as you say, climate change dare not say its name. How did that go?
That's right. So after I finished the initial sort of experimental soap opera version of this, which was webcast, where I sort of made up the story as I went along, I workshopped it in Miami, Florida with my director. Yeah, so it happened right there. And then when I premiered the play in the finished version in Austin, Texas, that also was the same month that Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast. So it all seemed fateful in a way that is perhaps not so pleasant, but maybe necessary.
And what's the religious angle here?
Okay, well, I just want to say that I think that America should be at the forefront of taking effective action about climate. And I don't think America will get on board without Christians getting on board. And just as Martin Luther King Jr. led a powerful civil rights movement because he explored the spiritual and moral dimensions of what he was struggling to achieve, I think that that's something that needs to happen in our storytelling. So I have a sort of a young Christian girl whose father is a Pentecostal preacher who begins to find herself speaking in the tongues of dying animals, of endangered animals, and sometimes even speaking in the tongues of endangered ecosystems. And she has no idea what it is. She's homeschooled. And then she sort of comes across this scientist who moves to her small town in Nevada, and he's there to try to save this endangered species of frog. And he himself is sort of obsessed with his mission and a bit arrogant and a bit dismissive of people with other points of view. You know, he's got a very secular point of view. And so what happens with these two characters is my way of kind of getting people to empathize with points of view that are very different from their own and understand that the spiritual and the moral dimensions of this problem can't be ignored, must be processed, must be felt, must be experienced in a human, down-to-earth, funny kind of way if we're really going to understand where we're at and act on it. I think we can't just understand facts. We have to understand the emotional and spiritual dimensions of where we're at.
And just to be clear, you play all the characters and you switch between them so very rapidly and so very convincingly. I don't know that I've seen anybody else do that.
Well, there are other people who do it. I do tell very long stories. That's why I call them performance novels, because, you know, it's drama and it's comedy, but it's got the structure of a novel. It's got a sort of a big canvas, kind of like a Dickens novel or other kind of social novels of the 19th century. Those are sort of my heroes, people like Dickens and Balzac and Harriet Beecher Stowe, of course, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, which, you know, was a hugely influential novel.
Now, when you have people like, for example, from the Tea Party in there, are they presented in such a way that we're supposed to laugh at them, or are we finding that everybody has a role to play in this story?
I think everybody has a role to play. I think I'm an equal opportunity ridiculer. I mean, I think we laugh at everybody in the story. But my goal as an artist is to give a prismatic, multifaceted view of our society and hopefully excite empathy in the listener. And that's why I think stories and art are just essential to this struggle, I guess, to awaken everyone to our reality. Because it's in empathizing, and that includes laughter, and, you know, it includes crying, and it includes eros, and only in really having that full human experience of what these issues portend can we really process them and then be compelled to act.
So how can we get a taste of what you do, and then how will we get to experience as the globe warms?
Okay, well, you can go to my website, which is www.heatherwoodbury.com, and that's W-O-O-D-B-U-R-Y, and just go to the As the Globe Warms page, and you can listen to the new episodes as they come out. There are 12 episodes altogether, and it will be complete on Earth Day, April 22nd. And I will be traveling around the country. I'd like to go to churches, libraries, bookstores, eco-encampments, and perform sections of this and speak about it and share the audio serial. And ultimately, I'd love for this story to just get out into the culture as much as possible. I think the more that people, whatever it is that you do, if you incorporate the urgency of this situation into whatever it is that you do, I think it will just start to permeate our culture and the narrative will start to change. So I think that artists have a role to play, but I think everyone should just do everything that they can think to do, and it will eventually sort of bleed into the everyday narrative of people's lives, and they'll say, wow, this is true, this is real, this is happening, let's do something.
So listeners, keep your eyes and ears out for this one. Seasoned performance artist Heather Woodbury and As the Globe Warms at heatherwoodbury.com. Thank you so much for talking with us, Heather.
Oh, thank you so much, Alex, for having me on.
Keep track of Radio EcoShock on Facebook, by Twitter, on our SoundCloud page, and our website, ecoshock.org. As always, I'll have more comments and lots of links in this week's blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.